And there'll be more news on 3LO and Radio 3 at 9 o'clock. Eastern Time is now 8 o'clock.
The Public Affairs Radio Department of the ABC presents The ABC at War. A tribute to the correspondents who've risked their lives and sometimes lost them in the job of keeping Australians informed about armed conflict in the world beyond our shores.
As the newly created Australian Broadcasting Commission began transmission in July 1932, Germany was holding elections that resulted in Adolf Hitler's National Socialist or Nazi Party gaining 230 seats in the Reichstag. 6 months later, Hitler was Germany's Chancellor. German radio began pouring forth the voice that propelled the Nazis to total power and the German people into total war. Also in July 1932, as Australians listened to the first sounds of their national broadcasting service, Japanese military officers were beginning the campaign of internal violence that was to spell the end of civil leadership of the parliamentary system and replace it with a government dominated by the armed forces. The Japanese people, too, were being propelled inexorably into total war. So also were Australians, though few of them then realised it. Even fewer would have heard that in July 1932, an ethereal-looking Vietnamese peasant named Ho Chi Minh, imprisoned by the British authorities in Hong Kong for taking part in the organization of the Indochina Communist Party, had slipped away from his captors and vanished back into the Soviet Union. All too many Australians were to realize the significance of that just 30 years later. July 1932, then, was not a time for thinking of war. For one thing, the effects of the Great Depression were still bearing down. But that wasn't to be the world's last economic slump, any more than the 1914-1918 war to end all wars was mankind's last expression of massive international violence. Bigger and better bangs were just below the horizon.
Well, we've had to wait rather longer than we anticipated for the blowing up of this part of the road because, as you heard the Don R say earlier, they had to wait till the last of the Greek artillery got through. It's now midnight, and it's absolutely dead quiet in the valley. Since then, things have been disturbed a little. As you heard, there was rather a vast commotion, and rather earlier than we anticipated, the whole caboose went up, and there was rocks flying everywhere all around us. And as a matter of fact, they landed so near that we had to run for the shelter of the bank. Noise of the explosion echoed down the valley, and once again, this road has been blown, I should say, with an extraordinary amount of success. Earlier in the evening, I went down to have a look at the places further down where the road was blown, and at a place which was blown in exactly the same way as this, there was a gap about 90 feet deep, and about 50 yards across. And as there was a sheer rock wall on the inside, it's a place which will be quite impossible to bypass without doing a considerable amount of work on it. And I should think that the blow that's just been made in this road will be very much the same sort of thing. And so the road between us and the Germans, we hope, has been successfully blocked. Fortunately, the good work done by the British sappers earlier in the day when they blew up the road down on the plain enabled the road to be kept open much longer than we anticipated up the hill. And that was why it was possible to get all the Greek artillery who wanted to come through out up this road before it had to be blown. We've waited until midnight, and now I think it's quite time we went. The broadcasting truck is the last truck to go out on this road, and we've got to take the engineers out who've just succeeded in blowing up this section of the road. And so we'll leave the infantry here who are going to guard this gap, and we'll go on, and tomorrow this will no doubt be the front line.
Greece, 1941, with Greek, British, Australian and New Zealand troops pulling back slowly, doggedly, but inevitably before the German advance, which had begun with 12 divisions on the 6th of April. 3 days later, the Germans took Salonika in a bid to drive a wedge between the bulk of the Greek army and its rear. British and Australian troops and engineers were called upon to hold the roads open for as long as possible, and then to blow gaps in them to delay the Nazi advance. The ABC's Chester Wilmot was there with sound engineers to record the event for Australians back home. Wilmot was to risk his life throughout World War II as he lived with the fighting troops at the heart of battles and sieges that were to make history. Nowhere more so than at Tobruk, where Australians, together with their allied brothers-in-arms, first shattered the Italian armies and then dug in to hold off the assault of the panzer armies of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel.
So long as men speak of the AIF, they'll speak of Tobruk and of the men who manned these guns. Men from Australia, Britain, India, Poland. There's no need to tell again of the heroism, the patience and the doggedness of this garrison. The world knows that already. But Tobruk is more than a front line and more than a fortress. It's a highly organized community with docks and hospitals, bakeries and distilleries, workshops and storehouses, refrigerating plants and power stations, offices and canteens. All these must be looked after if the men in the front lines are to be maintained and their guns are to be kept firing. And so Tobruk presents a complex picture of a closely integrated military and economic machine. Defending Tobruk means hard work and thorough organization as well as hard fighting. You'll realize this if you come with me and the microphone through the fortress from dockside to gun pit and from hospital to machine gun post, so that you may hear what actually happens during a typical day in Tobruk. And he who comes to Tobruk must come by sea, for Tobruk's lifeline is a sea lane. And so we go first to a destroyer side at night, while the troops are moving on and off and stores are being unloaded.
The ship is already alongside, and they've thrown down the gangway, and the troops are already moving off along. It's pitch dark, except for two pinpoints of light that are shining at either end of the gangway to show the troops their way, and off they come, trudging down it and away from the ship. They're pretty well laden up, because they've got their packs and their bedrolls on their backs, their haversacks and water bottles at their sides, their webbing, their full equipment, and their rifles. But you don't hear much of the sound of boot on gangway, because they're wearing rubber-soled desert boots, and so you don't hear the old sound of the iron horseshoe. And as these troops are coming off, there are other troops waiting to go on board. And with them are some of the wounded who are able to walk, and they'll be walking on up this gangway in a moment or two.
But in that moment or two, German bombers attacked, and Chester Wilmot turned his attention away from the troop ship.
3.7 guns, the heavy guns on the far side of the harbour, have already opened up on a plane whose distant drone we can just pick out. They got the guns on the north shore. Sharp spurts of flame shoot into the sky, and then high up above it, we see the pinpoint burst of bursting shells. Searchlight picks up a cloud way over on the north. It's the only searchlight going at the moment, and now the AK guns right behind us start up with their sharp metallic clatter. The searchlights are still searching for the plane, but it's bright moonlight and they haven't got much chance of picking him out. His drone goes louder. Here come the bombs now. Listen to them. They're falling in the harbour. In the harbour. They're making... The rumble of the bursting bombs dies away. They've fallen in the harbour about 500 yards from where we were. And there go the heavy AK guns on the north point, again combing the sky.
The plane got away, but the Allied troops in Tobruk weren't even considering getting away. They were there to stay, and Chester Wilmot stayed with them.
Out on the perimeter, the nightly machine gun battle has developed into something fiercer than usual. Our troops are making an attack on an enemy post, and they're supported by a strong artillery concentration and by machine guns and mortars. In reply, the enemy is putting down all his defensive fire, and many of his shells and mortars fall round the frontline weapon pit from which we observe and describe the action.
They're certainly answering with everything they can lay their hands on.
Yes, it's 75mm gun. They're landing around here now.
Well, I hope they continue to land only around here and not right here.
Thank you.
tightened up with pressure again now. And soon the pressure shows are steering towards our line. But at times even the pressure is dimmed by the fierce flashes of a burst of shells and bombs falling around their position.
And on through the night, the firefight rages on the perimeter.
Along with Chester Wilmot throughout the siege of Tobruk were the other members of the ABC's special broadcast team with the AIF. They were led by Lawrence H. Cecil, who was concerned about other things than Rommel's tanks and artillery.
Making recordings for broadcasting is a fairly simple matter if you're working with recording gear set up on a bench in a well-lit studio. But it's quite another matter when you try to make a recording in a dugout, in the back of a truck, or the floor of a tent, with a sandstorm raging outside and the dust filling the grooves of the disc as soon as they have been cut. In conditions like these, we made a recording of Christmas greetings from the most advanced Australian troops near Mersa Matru last December. I had 26 men in a small dugout, which was normally the sergeant's mess. The dugout was about 12 feet by 24, and so you can imagine a couple of dozen voices in that confined space was a problem in acoustics that I had difficulty in solving. Whilst poor Bill McFarlane, our engineer, outside in the driving sandstorm, was endeavouring to shield the equipment which was set up in the utility truck. After cutting the first record, he asked in despair if he could move the gear into an adjacent tent. With much willing help, we struggled through the blinding sand and set up in the tent. But this was worse. Everything covered over almost as fast as it could be dusted off. And so we were forced to bring everything back again to the truck, which was a little more protected than the tent, but unfortunately was made unstable by the wind. And this swaying added to the problem.
And while the ABC's war correspondents in the Libyan desert were trying to keep sand out of the grooves of the acetate discs onto which they were recording, other ABC correspondents in the Pacific theater of war were recording similar stories of heroism and tragedy onto acetate discs that threatened to curl up and warp in steamy and rain-sodden jungles. One such correspondent was Dudley Leggett in New Guinea. On Christmas Eve, 1942, he witnessed the beginning of the final push against strongly held Japanese positions at Buna.
The tanks have been warming up and are ready to move out from the coconut grove, not the coconut grove where they have been lying overnight on the edge of the new aerodrome, the new airfield of Buna, which we captured 3 days ago. Ready to move out down that across the bridge, across the Mimi Creek, over the bridge, which we repaired yesterday under fire, and so across towards the old strip, and about 400 or 500 yards further on, where the enemy are holding our infantry up. But it wasn't until these tanks went into operation 6 days ago, last Friday morning, that any substantial progress was made against the Japanese position. The gap was so well dug in, toolboxes were so numerous, arranged so well in depth, that our infantry had been unable to advance until last Friday, when the tanks were thrown in. And in that day, that morning, they advanced about 600 to 700 yards. The next day, they advanced best part of 1,000. And since then, they have again pushed on probably the best part of another 1,000 yards. And that was due to the fact that tanks broke through and blasted the toolboxes with their 37-millimeter cannon. When the tanks went into action for the first time, the infantry kept behind them right up to within 20 or 30 yards. And although the infantry give so much credit to the tanks for what the tanks have done, tanks are full of praise for the infantry, the way they followed through with the tanks right up to within a few yards of the enemy's pillboxes, where the enemy was still firing with machine guns, tossing out grenades. Because although the tanks were able to knock out about 80 pillboxes in that first morning, there were far more than 80 pillboxes there. And as a matter of fact, for 3 or 4 days after we had taken that area, snipers enemy snipers were still in that area, hiding in the innumerable dugouts, in the long grass, in the trees, avoiding casualties among our people going through the coconut grove, through that area. One peculiar experience that happened to the major in charge of our artillery. He was down near the water's edge the day of last Friday's attack, when a couple of Japanese were seen to dive into the water and swim out to sea. And then one, after swimming about 300 or 400 yards, turned and came in round in our area. Came out of the water, and according to the major, he was quite obviously crying. He had his hands up, and of course it seemed that he was going to surrender. He got within about 20 yards of the major when one of the major's bodyguard noticed that the Jap had one of his hands clenched. And then he suddenly realized that he had something that he was going to throw. I think that machine gun fire is at the Wirraway. They're just trying to have having a shot at, I think. I'm sure. But to return to the story, the major bodyguard saw this Jap pull a pin out of a grenade in his hand, strike the grenade on his helmet, and was just about to throw it when this lad fired and killed him. The Jap doubled up and the grenade went off in his hand. Now there are the MGs opening the tank and infantry attack. The attack's the best part of 1,000 yards from here, but it's almost a complete open stretch between us and where our troops are now attacking in the jungle, nearly halfway along the sides of the main airstrip, so that we should be able to hear the fire fairly clearly. The heavy slow machine gun fire is from the enemy's Hotchkiss, probably 0.5 or so, and from our Browning's Invictus. The lighter and more rapid is from the LMGs and rifles and from our Tommy guns. Our attack this morning is on the left flank and is trying to push the enemy to the far end of the main airstrip where he has his main supply dump and final defenses. Unfortunately, we've already lost 3 tanks and everybody's wondering whether we can keep the remaining ones in action because the element of surprise is now gone and tanks are getting close to the positions of the few remaining heavy guns the enemy has left. And these guns may very likely stop our tanks. As a result, I don't think we'll be able to finish the Jap off just yet. And if tomorrow is Christmas Day, it looks as though Christmas Day will just be another day in the week for our fellows here. Transport's limited this part of the world, and most of it's needed for the ordinary food and fighting supplies. I guess our parcels and celebrations will just have to wait until we finish the Jap off here. Maybe by New Year.
1944, Bougainville. The Japanese were still fighting on. John Hind, now a film critic for the ABC, was then in another theatre, the Drama Theatre of the Pacific. He'd seen plenty of fighting, been on bomber raids and other equally dangerous missions. And his stories were frequently about individual acts of heroism. Like this one.
City is one of a force of Fijians, trained and officered by New Zealanders, which has been fighting since last December alongside the Americans in and outside the Empress Augusta Bay beachhead on Bougainville Island. The jungle fighting of these Fijians has become a legend in the South Pacific. One of their important jobs has been to spot Japanese positions and then lead American dive bombers over to destroy them. That's really where the story of Siti Karabalavala begins. On January the 27th this year, Siti was chosen to guide a formation of United States dive bombers to a Japanese position out across the jungle. The mission was successful, and later that afternoon, Siti climbed into a Cub aircraft piloted by Lieutenant Chuck Cross to fly back to Ebu, 40 miles out from the Allied beachhead. They were nearly there when the weather closed in. Rain and cloud blotted out Ebu, and the two men were hopelessly lost in their tiny reconnaissance plane, somewhere above the Japanese. Lieutenant Cross tried to return to Piba Airfield, inside the American beachhead, but the little plane's petrol supply was low, and somewhere over the mile-high Emperor Range, the motor coughed and died. Somehow in the rain and darkness, the 22-year-old American pilot managed to put his Cub down on top of an enormous tree. It hung there undamaged except for a broken propeller. But in the pouring rain and mist, neither of the men could see the ground. City moved first. He worked his way down the landing gear like an acrobat, and hanging by one hand, found he could grip the 2-foot trunk of the tree with his legs and his free arm. Lieutenant Cross climbed down onto the Fijian's shoulders, and he hugged the slippery tree trunk as well. Then, at a signal, City let go of the landing gear, and they both slid down the tree trunk. Sitting there in the rain and fog, with their last tie to civilization already lost to sight in the treetops above them, they took stock of the situation. City had carried the only compass that they possessed. Now he found it was broken. The only armament they had was a small penknife that City carried in his pocket. They had no food whatever. For days they climbed precipitous shoulders, with the fog swirling round them, shivering with the cold of the 5,000 feet altitude. It rained endlessly, and every valley was noisy with streams. They could find no food, and after a time, Lieutenant Cross became ill. City carried him part of each day. On the sixth day, Cross fell exhausted. City climbed a tree to make a survey. What he saw brought him down thunderstruck and shaken. From this tree, he'd seen Bucca Island across the passage at the north end of Bougainville. For the first time, the two men realized that they had been heading north instead of south. Now they were on the fringes of the main Japanese stronghold in the Northern Solomons. The two men sat for a while, and then they turned back over the terrible country they had just crossed. The American grew steadily weaker, and for 5 days, City carried him almost every yard of their journey. On February the 9th, 14 days after the crash, they reached the foot of Mount Balbi again, and then the American boy decided he could go no further. City said, "I can carry you some more," and he picked up Cross. But he found his own knees were buckling under him. He tried again, but he couldn't manage it. And after a while, he found that both of them were crying. In the end, Cross forced City to go ahead. They both thought that there was just a chance City could get help back in time. But before he left, City built a shelter for the young pilot. And as a last gesture, he stripped off his own underwear and gave it to Cross for an extra protection in the wet, cold nights. They parted sorrowfully. The fog closed in again, and City, turning for the last time before he began the climb up the ranges, could no longer see Cross in the undergrowth. By the 11th of February, City was so weak that he often had to sit down on the slopes and slide. One day he fell into 5 streams and then over a cliff and down a waterfall. And then, at the end of weeks without food, the battered Fijian lieutenant stumbled on a dwarf coconut tree with a load of coconuts. Only 10 feet above the ground these coconuts were, and yet City struggled vainly for 2 hours with that tree, climbing and slipping until he thought he'd never manage to get up again. Then he found his boots were still on his feet. His feet were so numb that he'd forgotten he ever wore boots. Lying on the ground, he found they wouldn't come away from his swollen feet, so he wrapped a handkerchief around the broken knife blade and slashed both his boots and his leggings away. Both feet were raw, covered with enormous blood blisters. Before he made another attempt on the coconuts, he had to break the blisters with his teeth and suck the blood away from them. And then, in agony, he made 6 more tries to climb the tree before he managed to grasp a branch and dislodge 3 green coconuts. He fell to the ground with part of the branch in his hand. After a little coconut milk, City's vision cleared a little, and he found he was almost at the end of his journey. Across the valley, there was a small native garden, and he crawled on hands and knees up the jungle-covered slopes until he fainted on the edge of the clearing. The next thing he knew, there was water on his face and native boys clustered around him. That was the end of City's 32 days of hell. They sent a search party out for Cross immediately, and they also sent a radio message to Fiji telling of City's safe return. Back at home, City's family and friends were celebrating a feast to the honored dead because they'd given up all hope for City. A New Zealand brigadier carried City's first letter to his weeping wife, and all Fiji hung out flags to celebrate the return of one of its sons.
In the European theater, too, man had been committed to the air in fragile craft to take their chances among the enemy. Chester Wilmot was there for the ABC.
The airborne forces which landed in France last night are being reinforced at the moment. It's just about 9 o'clock and a whole mass of gliders has just come in, having been towed across the channel from Britain. They've received a particularly severe welcome from the German AKAC defences, and the flak has been going up from all around us because we're hemmed in on two or three sides here by Germans. But so far as I've seen, no glider has been hit, and all the tug planes have managed to drop their loads and swing safely away. We're going to shell the landing zone, the rough cloud strip, where the gliders are coming in to land. A lot of their shells have been falling short and landing in and around this building from which I'm speaking. But so far, as far as I know, none have been landing up near the landing zone, where the last of the gliders are now banking round and coming in to touch down. Above, there is a fleet of Spitfires and Thunderbolts that have been protecting the gliders and their tugs in this perilous cross-channel crossing. That was another enemy shell landing a little bit further away from here and landing, I think, very near the landing zone where the gliders are coming down now. I can see about four or five coming in through the trees, skimming very low over the ploughed field and coming in to touch down. There'll barely be room for them. There'll barely be room for them to get down there because the Germans have studded the whole field with poles. And last night, a large number of gliders came down there, and many of them crashed on hitting the poles or in bouncing over the rough ground.
That was the first week of June 1944. 3 weeks later, Chester Wilmot was covering the British advance through France.
This is Chester Wilmot speaking from the far side of the River Oder. I've just driven through our corridor in an armoured fighter, and now I'm on the high ground that our infantry and armour have been holding on the south side of the Odon since Tuesday night. It's much quieter in the corridor today than it was yesterday. There are still a few snipers about, and occasionally bursts of machine gun fire come cracking through the trees from small pockets of Germans who are still holding out on the flank. But in spite of this, the narrowest part of the corridor has been widened from less than a mile to more than a mile and a half. We now have all this high ground around 0.112, and our infantry are there as well as the tanks, and we've just jumped with a small counterattack on the right. We can still see the smoke signals of this battle. On the far side of the rise, half a mile away, the smoke of three brewed-up tanks is still rising in thick black columns. Every few minutes, a German mortar crumps down on the other side of the ocean. And occasionally, a machine gun opens up. Apart from that, there's little sign of enemy activity. Our gunners are still pumping quite a few rounds into the wood on the far side of point 112. In order to keep the Boche tanks quiet and keep them back in the wood. But otherwise, there's little to indicate that I'm speaking now only 400 or 500 yards from the tip of the spur, which British troops have crossed across the River Oder, and barely 2 miles from the River Orne. Things are now getting a little more lively. Apparently, enemy tanks have moved out from the wood, and now guns across the road are opened up with fairly stiff barrels. And I've got some anti-tank guns and SP guns not very far away from me are also firing. Actually, from where I am, I'm not in a good position to see what's happening because I'm fairly well established behind two thick stone walls beside a road, but you can judge from the amount of noise that's going on that the artillery is giving the Germans quite a pasting.
Well, even in the midst of mayhem, nature reasserts its presence. But the gods of battle still required more victims. And as the fighting in both the European and Pacific theatres reached its climax, ABC correspondents were there to record the sacrifice. Mandalay, Burma, 10th of March, 1945. Major General Rees, commander of the 19th Indian Division, put down the sword and took up the microphone.
The frontier force, they're tackling Mandalay Fort now.
You can probably hear the noise, the shelling, mortaring, our own tanks shooting. I'm fairly close to the walls myself, standing, looking half round a concrete wall. Our chaps are advancing steadily, advancing a little more than I'd like to see them. They're going very well. The tanks are advancing, firing very hard at the walls. You can see where our medium guns, firing direct, have made breaches in the walls of the fort. You can see the bullets flicking ground just ahead of me. I think actually they're our own tank bullets. The tank beezers, coaxial, firing ahead of the infantry, smothering the operation. I can see one of our infantry running across now, just near the fort wall. I'll get my glasses on. I can see the breach, but there's a big moat this side. I can now see some of our leading infantry. They've just doubled behind a concrete shelter, which the sappers had built before the war, because we're standing now in the sapper lines just north of Mandalay Fort.
Well, Major Generals weren't the only ones reporting the war for the ABC. The ABC's General Manager, Charles Moses, had left his desk and moved to the banks of the Rhine to report the Allied crossing into the heart of Germany.
Well, it's just 10 minutes past nine, and those commanders are already well on their way across the Rhine. The first fight must be very near the other side. I can see the flash of the German small arms and also machine gun fire as they're pouring it into the crocodiles. And the second flight is just marking the embankment just under, right under our nose up here. From the crocodiles in the fire, I can see answering fire from machine guns directed at the opposite shore. The helm of this building is shaking, and you can hear every now and again the whine of shells passing over us, and the also the whistle of bullets ricocheted obviously from the north end of the Rhine just underneath us. The second flight are now just moving into the Rhine itself, and the first flight must be far past the other side. These British commanders are taking us without artillery support, the most hazardous job, and probably requiring greater courage than any other similar feat during the whole of this war. Well, I hear the engines of the third flight moving up, and very soon they'll be crossing that bank, which lies just immediately in front of us, between us and the Rhine. Yes, I can see another one going over the top now, just like a herd of prehistoric animals, balanced on the top of this bank, probably about 150 yards away from it, and now moving down, and down and into the river.
And further upstream?
The detective woman speaking at 30 seconds to 9 o'clock on the evening of March the 23rd. In 30 seconds from now, the buffaloes carrying the assaulting troops will begin to cross the Rhine. The Rhine is now dark. Both his guns and the machine guns which were firing tracer bullets over its surface have stopped, except for four or five Bofa's guns which here are firing single shots to guide the buffaloes up to the water's edge. Straight past this building from which I'm speaking goes a stream of tracers, and guided by that, buffaloes are moving in the darkness up to the water's edge. I'm looking through my glasses now to see if I can see any of them silhouetted against the skyline on the bank. I'm speaking from a position about 300 yards from the Rhine. I can see the water clearly in the light of these tracers fired up by the Bofa's guns. Tracers are going high, well above the river, and they take a trail of light across, and that guides the buffaloes carrying the troops up to the point where they're going to the water.
General Manager and Correspondent. In all-out war, there wasn't a dividing line. From then on, it was just another slogging match for another 2 months. Then, on the 4th of May, 1945...
This is Chester Wilmot speaking from Field Marshal Montgomery's tactical headquarters on a high, wind-topped hill on the wild Lüneburger Heath near the River Elbe. It's 10 minutes past six on Friday, May the 4th, the hour and the day for which British fighting men and women and British people throughout the world have been fighting and working and waiting for 5 years and 8 months. The commanders of the German forces opposing Field Marshal Montgomery's 21st Army Group
have come to this headquarters today to surrender. To make unconditional surrender. And here they are now. Now inside the tent, which is an ordinary camouflaged army tent. The five German telepotentials are standing around the table. An ordinary army table covered with rust army blankets. Two machine gun launchers, the salute, and he sits down.
We assemble here today to accept the surrender terms which have been made with a delegation from the German army.
Efficient and gentlemanly. War in Europe was like that for the generals.
The German generals have left the tent. They're moving through the trees to the visitors' camp where they will spend the night as visitors in Paul Wasser Montgomery's headquarters. And the Paul Wasser himself has walked briskly across the grass square in front of his caravan, entered and closed the door behind him. The day's work is done. The triumph of the British armies in Europe is complete.
In the Pacific, however, the war still had some way to run.
Here comes the Odyssey, Captain Larrikin. In just a kick-off, waiting for the trend.
Charakan, an authentic and historical documentary on the landing of the AIF on Charakan on May the 1st, 1945. Written and produced by Frank Legg from actual recordings he made on the troop ship Manura and on Charakan Island itself. The words of the song used in this documentary were written by Privates Colby and Corrigan of the 2nd 48th Battalion AIF. The following day, Corrigan was drowned during an assault landing practice for the invasion at Moratize. The song to the air of Lily Marlene was sung by the men on the troop ship on the way to the invasion.
Hello, everybody. This is Frank Legg broadcasting from B deck on HMAS Manura, an Australian troop ship anchored off Moratize on the 25th of April, 1945. The 2nd 48th Battalion is aboard this ship, and in 6 days' time, they are invading the island of Tarakan off Borneo. At the moment, there's a rehearsal of the first wave of boats to go ashore taking place down below in the water. And up here on B deck, the remainder of the battalion is assembled because we're expecting a visit very shortly from the CNC, General Sir Thomas Blamey. We're hoping that he's going to address the troops about the coming show, and if he does, we'll record it for you.
I know you've got very, very tired of waiting in Australia, and it's very boring to go on with too much training. But you're really going now for the first time since we left the Middle East onto foreign soil again. You're going to see, as you know, main Dutch oil port, and it's the AIF revived. And we're all very, very confident of it, and you are yourselves, because you know you're well fit and well trained. And I don't want to keep talking to you, I just want to say that we're looking with great interest to this first move out of Australia again. We're perfectly certain of your success, and we wish you all the very best of luck.
Gradually, Japanese commanders were forced to surrender, but there was a different atmosphere. Stopwatch efficiency and gentlemanly behaviour weren't the overriding factors. This was the Orient, and face was paramount. As Frederick Simpson discovered at a surrender of Japanese forces in Kuching on the 6th of September, 1945.
This broadcast was delayed some minutes ago. The Japanese general sent a message out on the landing stage where he was to come from that he was indisposed. The brigadier sent back a message ordering him to present himself to sign these formalities. Here he comes now.
Sir, General Yamamura reporting to sign the instrument of surrender.
I will read to you
the document of surrender. In accordance with General Order No. 1, by direction of the Emperor, I, Major General Hayao Yamamura, Commanding General, Japanese Forces Kuching, hereby proclaim the unconditional surrender to the command of the Kuching Force of all Japanese armed forces and all armed forces under Japanese control in Sarawak, south of the line.
Still seems to be some doubt as to what the Japanese are deciding. That they will sign, of course, is without question, but seemingly Major General Ram Yamamura wants to know something more about the interpretation of the document.
The end result was inevitable, but General Yamamura saved face to the last.
Instructions were issued by Lieutenant General Baba.
Brigadier Eastick is just at this moment telling the Japanese interpreter that Major General Baba signed the surrender instrument at Labuan yesterday.
I therefore require Major General Yamamura to forthwith sign the instrument of surrender. He will move around to the table and sign the document here.
Everybody is tensely waiting. He's still not ready to take up that pen for the signature. It is being told to Brigadier Eastick by the interpreter that Yamamura has had no signal from Baba, who signed the document yesterday. He's moving around now to take the chair. Brigadier Eastick has just vacated it. Yamamura has his sword. He's sitting down now, the chair. Lady spectacle case. He's being pointed out the place to sign the document. Interpreter inquires whether Major General Yamamura will sign in English. Has been told to him that he will. Well, there was a blot from the pen, one of these human incidents, and he's actually smiled as he puts his signature onto the document.
And on the same day, Hayden Leonard described the atmosphere in Singapore.
Singapore has had its first day of freedom for 3.5 years, and it's been freedom in more senses than one. The streets are crowded with Chinese and Malays. They cheer anyone in a British or Australian uniform. And you've got to know these people to realize how they can cheer. This morning, they crowded in thousands around the municipal building, watching groups of surly Japanese coming in to receive orders from the British authorities. And you only had to stand in those groups and listen to their conversations to know with what intense hatred they loathe the Japs. And the Japs know it. No one had to tell these Orientals from Tokyo. They could feel the hatred of the crowds, and I think quite a few seem to think that Singapore's first lynching was about to begin. Perhaps they were right. The Japs, I mean, if it hadn't been for the armed guards around the building. Personally, if I were a Jap, I wouldn't walk through Chinatown in Singapore for £1 million. Money's no good when you're dead.
But back in Sydney, there was no such undercurrent of hatred, as an ABC general manager-to-be reported.
Hello, everyone. This is Talbot Duck Madden speaking to you from Martin Place, Sydney. But I'm afraid that today, it's not the old Martin Place that you know so well. There's no bus outside the airways office here. There's no constable on duty at Pitt Street directing the traffic. There are no office boys posting mail at the letterboxes. Instead, there are thousands and thousands of people. Honestly, I've never seen so many people in Martin Place before. They're packed tight from above Castlereagh Street all the way down across Pitt Street, past the Cenotaph, and way down here to the George Street end of Martin Place, where we have the mobile studio park. There are men, women and girls, lovely girls too, hundreds and hundreds of them. They've got paper hats on their heads, waving streamers, flags, Union Jacks, the Stars and Stripes. They've got whistles, those gas alarm rattlers, and they're just having one whale of a time. It's about an hour since the official news came through, and of course most of these young people were on their way to the offices, and so they've just stayed in town. I heard somebody down below say they stayed in just for the fun of it. And there's certainly plenty of fun here in this heart of Sydney this morning.
After 6 years of war, it was time for fun. Time to enjoy the peace. But already the forces of conflict were back at work. Independence movements were gathering strength in Asia. The spectre of communism hovered there and in Europe. China bubbled on like a huge cauldron. The people of the Indian subcontinent died in their thousands in the name of partition. Arabs and Jews killed each other in the Middle East. Cold War, hot war. Berlin Airlift, Korea, Czechoslovakia, Suez, Malaya, Indochina, Congo, Vietnam, Bangladesh, Vietnam, Kenya, Vietnam, Cyprus, Vietnam. ABC correspondents were soon back at war again.
Sam, the young platoon commander, had rounded up about 30 villagers, mainly old men and women, and had grouped them in front of the leading tank. He gave his orders through his Vietnamese interpreter.
All right, tell them that we're going to use them just like we did before, holding hands, walking across this area to that tree line over there.
Bây giờ hả, tay cầm tay hả, đi thưa ra mà đi thẳng tới cái bên cây kia kia, nghe không? Yes, sir.
Okay. I was frankly appalled. Surely the Marines weren't going to use the villagers as human mind detectors. Well, yes, as it happened, but the move wasn't as callous as I'd first thought. The villagers, it seemed, had certain inside information on the placing of the mines.
They usually know where they are.
Yes. Decided to call in an artillery strike on the village we'd shot up with the tanks earlier to try and dislodge a sniper there.
Sacred Whiskey Rear, this is Echo 4, fire mission, over. Coordinate 019613, azimuth 2000. Snipers firing from village. This is Echo 4 into mission. Sniper stop firing. Good coverage of the target. Out.
Wall of sandbags. I came upon the soldier who'd been sitting with us a minute or two earlier. He was crouched down and had a small, clear plastic file open in one hand. He was in the process of shaking out some white powder into the palm of his other hand. He looked up, startled, as I came up to him. I was as shocked as he, but I suppose I recovered quicker, and for some unknown reason, probably wanting to put him at ease, although I'd never before seen anyone taking heroin, said to him in a quite relaxed manner, "What's that? Speed?" "Yes," he said in a rather embarrassed way, putting it first to one nostril and then the other, sniffing deeply as though it was a harmless pinch of snuff.
Here in the terminal building at Suzhou Airport, 8 miles south of Hue, refugees are everywhere, sleeping on benches in the passenger lounge, clustered on the stairway leading up to the control tower. The pilots say that if rockets or artillery hit the airport, they'll get airborne as quickly as possible and circle somewhere safe until they can return. The refugees are taking with them on the planes everything they can carry. I saw one young boy struggling up the stairway with an electric fan, almost as big as himself. Others are loaded up with pots and pans, clothing, food, water, babies, and even chickens. The refugee flights will continue until all those who want to leave have gone, unless the communist offensive on Hue makes civilian flying too hazardous. Meanwhile, out on the road to Da Nang, thousands of refugees are still streaming south, mainly on buses and trucks.
I'm standing in front of a large water-filled ditch that runs for about 15 yards. In the distance, about 100 yards away, is one ruined building. And that's all that's left of My Lai. This is the ditch that Lieutenant Calley is supposed to have shot all these civilians in. It's quite eerie because there's nothing here, and it's just very, very hard to believe that this is the scene of this massacre. Very, very strange to look down into this ditch, and it's just got water in it now, although they tell me that there was no water in it before. The soldiers stood off at a distance while we filmed the area for a period of about 10 minutes or so. The only sound the whole time, the sound of the wind in the pines along the edge of the irrigation ditch.
Tim Bowden, John Pennington, Ian Finlay. Just three of the many ABC correspondents who reported on a war that killed somewhere between 3 and 4 million people, devastated much of Indochina, and threatened to destroy the political systems of every outside nation, Australia's included, that became involved. And just as the fighting in the paddy fields and jungles of Indochina had an effect in the wider world, so too did the conflict being waged back and forth across the shifting sands of the Middle East. One city seems to have been the epicentre of the upheaval for as long as most of us can remember. Beirut.
Since being joined
by rebel Lebanese army units, the left-wing forces have been making steady gains. After taking what's left of the Holiday Inn Hotel from right-wing Christian groups, there was a point at which the battle could have gone either way, because the leftists and people living in the hotel district began looting what few portable goods still remained inside the hotel. Once this was stopped, the left-wing groups and the rebel Lebanese soldiers began pushing the right-wing forces back steadily towards their headquarters between the port and the city center. Both sides have been trying to collect their dead and wounded, but bodies still lie in the rubble, and in parts of the city center, no one has been able to get near trapped people wounded a day or 2 days ago. It's one thing to go out and report a battle or an air raid, and quite another to shelter in one's own home while bombs and rockets explode all round. Most homes have at least one area safer than all the rest. For me, it's a hallway 6 feet long by 4 feet wide. There'd be a hissing, whistling noise, and then silence. For about 2 seconds, then the crashing explosion. When one landed near the house, there'd be a shower of dirt and rubble and shrapnel on the roof and past the open windows. Many people didn't know they should open their windows, so whole fronts of apartment buildings, which are little more than windows, are now piles of shattered glass in the street. I wrapped my small son in a quilt and jammed him into a corner. A mattress was an extra buffer, and at the height of the bombing, as mortars and rockets were whistling in on us, I covered him with my body and another quilt and turned up the radio full blast to try to drown some of the worst of the explosions. I'm leaving for a couple of months, and I've taken the opportunity to go with the American evacuation convoy because there is no other really safe way out of here at the moment. It's supposed to be overland to Damascus, and the road very often is cut by bombing and fighting of one sort or another. If this happens and the convoy does not meet, the Americans have made an alternative arrangement to perhaps take the evacuees out by sea.
I'm now watching and hearing outgoing fire from the Palestinians towards where the Israeli positions are. There's another one just going off. A short time later, Israeli airstrikes began on the camps and also on sections of the coastal road linking Tyre to Beirut. There it is. There's the Israeli jet. He's going in now, right now on the camp, and there he goes. Here comes another. Out of the sun. Starting straight down now, going straight into that camp. Oh, Nick, the bombers. Huge, ugly black clouds of billowy, oily-looking smoke coming up from a tree line there, just on the left side of the camp, about three or four kilometers. There's some small arms fire from behind me. Well, here comes another one, coming straight out of the sun.
Diane Wilman and Paul Murphy. Again, only two of the ABC correspondents who risked their lives to cover the never-ending Middle East conflict.
The breakthrough came shortly after the conference chairman, Britain's Foreign Secretary Lord Carrington, agreed that the Patriotic Front guerrilla fighters should have equal status with the white-led security forces in the run-up to the next election. Once a ceasefire has been negotiated, a British-appointed governor will fly to Salisbury to effectively run the country during the two-month election campaign. He will be assisted by a Commonwealth peacekeeping force. Australian and British troops are almost certain to be part of that force.
Tony Joyce covered wars in Vietnam, the Indian subcontinent, the Middle East and Africa. On the 16th of November 1979, he reported that breakthrough in the Zimbabwe peace talks from the ABC's London office, shortly before flying out to neighbouring Zambia to follow the story further. 5 days later, on the 21st of November 1979, he became a casualty of that same vicious civil war.
It was in fact an ambush set up. And the first shot was fired at us to stop us. And the place that we stopped was sort of covered by a machine gun. We got out of the car, sort of more or less to find out what happened. And And then, there were some guys running down the road towards us from the direction of the bridge, from the direction of where the shot was fired from. They shouted at us from down the road that we'd stand in the middle of the road with our hands up, don't move, we'll shoot, and things like that. When they finally came up to us, they searched us, and they were yelling at us that we were white imperialists and... we're going to shoot all you whites and that sort of thing. There was a whole lot of people in uniform milling around, with guns, AK-47s, rifles, that sort of thing. But all the time, there was one particular guy who was dressed in civilian clothes. Well, he was just wearing a pair of black trousers and no shirt, but he was waving about a automatic pistol in his hand. And he struck me at the time as being a lunatic, and I thought that he was the one we had to worry about. The police arrived. There was a bit of an argument about who controlled us, really. The police seemed to prevail at the time, where they put us into the back of a police car. There were three of us all together, Tony and I and the Zambian taxi driver, and they were moving our equipment from the taxi to the police car to go back to Lusaka. And it seemed as though we were okay, except this fellow that I was talking about, the guy in the black trousers, was always in the background, and he was sort of, dancing about, very agitated, fairly wild-eyed, waving this pistol about. And then eventually, as though the other people were moving the equipment from the taxi to the police car, he just stood off and fired a shot into the back of the car and it hit Tony. I sort of looked around and Tony was sitting beside me. I felt the sort of jerk of Tony because, we were touching because we were sort of cramped up in the back of the car. I looked around and Tony had been hit. He was covered in blood. He was obviously, to me, in bed. I thought he was dead. And I grabbed him by the hand. We were sitting in the back of the car, and I sort of grabbed him by the hand, and I felt his hand squeeze mine, and then I realized that he wasn't dead. So I started yelling. They hustled the fellow that shot Tony. They hustled him away, and I started screaming at the police to get going, and we had to get Tony to a hospital as quickly as possible.
Derek McKendry, the ABC cameraman who accompanied Tony Joyce on many of his trips to war. Tony Joyce died in a London hospital on the 4th of February 1980. He was not the first ABC correspondent to die doing his job of reporting war. But his death brought home to thousands of Australians the price that sometimes paid so that they may know at first hand about the world beyond these shores.
You've been listening to The ABC at War, a tribute to ABC correspondents who have covered the many conflicts that have occurred in the world since the Australian Broadcasting Commission was formed on the 1st of July 1932. The programme was written and narrated by Brian Furlonger. Research was carried out by Tony Jones and David McLaughlin. Johnny Bwin and Dennis Peterson were the technical assistants.